Dr. Alexander, thank you so much for joining us on the Hear Us Out podcast today to talk a little bit about auditory processing. Why don't you give people a little bit of background about yourself, kind of how you became an audiologist and specializing in auditory processing?
Hello, hello. So I'm Angela Alexander. I'm originally from Kansas, but then I've also lived in the Virgin Islands, LA, New Zealand, and Australia. Where I'm at right now, it is 6 a.m. in Australia. So it's bright and early here for me, but the sun comes up around 4. So it doesn't feel like it's, you know, that early. So when I was growing up in Kansas, our next door neighbor was an audiologist. And my mom, who was a nurse and home health care worker, noticed that I wasn't responding to sound the way she expected me to when I was very young, like before 1 year of age. She was really kind of concerned that I might have hearing loss. So it started this longstanding relationship with our next door neighbor of him checking my hearing, and over the years, my mom would say, it just really doesn't feel like she's hearing me, but all of my hearing tests were normal. Oh, isn't this interesting, right?
Yes.
So then I had looked into a lot of different professions. In fact, I think I changed my major in college like 10 times. It started as speech language pathology and audiology, and then I had like a different flavor of the week. Tried all of them on and then came back to audiology. But it was actually a take your daughter to work day when I was, I think, maybe 8 years old. I went to the school where my mom was a school nurse, and the speech language pathologist had a book on Coco the gorilla. And because I loved apes and monkeys so much, I was like, wait, there's a job where I can maybe teach apes to speak. And now I'm working with the greatest of apes.
When was humans. That book? The reason why I ask that is because in the 1950s, my grandfather was a speech pathologist, and my mom, who's an audiologist, told me this story. And I think there was a newspaper clipping of it, of these people who had an ape or some chimp type animal came to my mom's house when she was a child because they wanted to solicit my grandfather to try and get this animal to speak. Nothing ever came of it, but that's you mentioning that book.
Why would they bring them to your grandfather? Tell me, what was that about?
So he was a speech pathologist, and we're in New Jersey, and he was probably the original speech pathologist in New Jersey in the very early 1950s.
Holy!
Yeah.
You know what? I think we may have a lot in common.
Sounds like it.
That's awesome. So
we'll
cool.
See where this all goes.
Yeah, it's so cool. And then in April of 2004, I was at the University of Kansas getting my undergrad in speech language hearing sciences. And I came in late because I had a bowling class right before. I wanted to bowl one more game. And I walked in and there was like a guest lecturer. And I was like, oh my God, I totally forgot about that. And so I went and I sat down in the front row. There was one seat left. It was front and center. And I was like, oh God. I have to be awkward. So I went in, sat down, and then it blew my mind. I was like, oh my goodness, auditory processing disorder is something that exists and it can be treated. So I went up to the guest lecturer afterward and I was like, I've got to see this. I want to come to your clinic. I want to see how it's tested, how it's treated, because right now I can't even imagine what that looks like. He was like, sure, just email me. It's my name at buffalo.edu is my email address. And I'm like, okay, so what's your name? He's like, Jack Katz. And I'm like,
the guy in the textbook.
My textbook says your name. Yeah. So that's how it all started. And then I started going to Jack's office in April of 2004. It's literally been 20 years since that moment. The moment that completely changed my life and the focus for me moving forward.
First of all, I have to say auditory processing is my absolute favorite part of audiology. I haven't even pinpointed why it's my favorite. Maybe it's the puzzle piece aspect of it, of trying to piece all these tests together and come up with a diagnosis. maybe it's because I kind of resonate with it, even though I myself have not been diagnosed with APD, but I'll get to that. But my big question with the Buffalo model, is, so it consists of speech and noise, phonemic synthesis, and SSW.
Yes.
SSW, I find, is a very comprehensive test, but it is, I would think it's pretty antiquated at this point, because some of the words are just not used daily, especially by kids anymore. And it has this static track in the background. So when you see kids or patients with this, how do you go about SSW testing?
That is such a good question. Okay. So the SSW has been around for a very long time. And you know what? That static background track isn't actually a background track. It's just the tape recorder. You can actually hear Jack clicking the tape recorders on and off as he's doing it.
But I'm never going to unhear that now. Wow.
Right? I mean, so it has been re-recorded 3 times. And it was really interesting because they wanted to clean up the recording, make it better, modernize some of the words, things like that. And we all know which words we're talking about. And Jack also thinks there's like 3 test items that aren't really telling us a lot about auditory processing, but then it kind of throws off all of the norms. So he's like, Angela, you can do that. That's in your lifespan instead. You just, here you go, which is hilarious. So the SSW does feel antiquated. But here's the deal. A lot of us as audiologists don't see people who don't have problems, right? It's really hard because we aren't getting a normative sample. We are getting people who have problems. But when you see children who come in, who hear those test items that we see people missing often, and they get all of those words right, it shows you that it is not just, I mean, like, it actually makes the test more sensitive, right? Mm-hmm. We have to worry about a ceiling effect with audiology tests. If tests are too easy, it tells us nothing about how a person's auditory processing abilities are. And I think there's something about the SSW test that a lot of audiologists miss, and that's qualitative information. We are not just looking at if a person gets something right or wrong. We're also looking at what did it take for them to get it right. The Australian SSW has just been made a few years ago. The recording quality is sultry. It is probably the sexiest sounding SSW.
Are you ready? Upstairs, downtown.
And
things
it's
you didn't
like,
expect you'd get in an audiology podcast.
Right? Right? So this, like, the recording quality is peak. I mean, it is nice, very nice. And I am using it right now. At the current moment, I am seeing slight difficulties with that ceiling effect, you know? Mm-hmm. And Jack said that that happened with one of the 3 recordings of the SSW with the U.S. American English dialect, that the test somehow was able to be harder for those without auditory processing issues and easier for those with. And so he was like, screw it, I'm going back to the other one. That told me more. So I understand where audiology is coming from. And we almost have this push-pull sometimes. Is something too old? Is something too new? Is something too old? Who cares? Just if it's telling you good stuff, use it. And if not, replace it with something else. Doesn't matter, right?
So even though what people are typically looking at is the antiquated aspects of that test are actually giving information that other tests can't give. As you're saying that, it reminds me of a patient that I had once where we do a lot of sound field testing with hearing aids as a means of deciding, hey, is it time to upgrade or not? How would new be versus your old technology? And I had a patient once with her old hearing aids, 0% discrim. Her new hearing aids, 0% discrim. She walked out of the booth and said, I love these. And I said, my testing is just not capturing that. So I think it brings up the idea of really understanding not just the responses we're getting, but how are we getting those responses? Are those patients responding quicker? Are they seeming to get the task more efficiently? So paying attention to that qualitative information within the data can also be interpreted.
This is, and you know what? You're bringing up perfect points here. And I think we need to be more critical of the test that we use, not in how old the test is or, you know, we need to be more critical of, does this test help us understand that person more, what that person is struggling with, what that person needs help with, what that person is saying when they come in. When I moved from the US to New Zealand, I was like, Angela, stop being a weird audiologist and just doing Jack's tests. Do all the normal ones everybody else is doing, right? So I started adding in, I was doing a test battery that was dichotic digits, where we're hearing two numbers in two ears at the same time, where they overlap. I was doing some pitch pattern stuff. I was doing random gap detection. I was doing all of these things. And then at the end of the test, the parents would look at me and they would say, can you see what I told you? And I could not relate what I had seen on those tests to their lived experience. And I think that we need to be able to do that as audiologists. Like, it makes more sense for us to do things that have relevance. And if we cannot directly tie what is happening on those tests to the patient experience, we are creating a further gap in patient-centered care. And that is a huge issue in audiology.
So within what you're talking about there, if you have a patient where their case history, their symptoms are not aligning with your test results, would you still advise treating the symptoms? And I ask that question because I think in some of the more specialized areas of audiology, whether it comes to tinnitus, whether it comes to vestibular, there are times we treat symptoms when we can't capture results on tests. And as I'm listening to you speak, this sounds like one of those umbrellas within audiology where we may be serving our patients by implementing that sort of practice style.
Absolutely. Okay. So I have this little bit of an analogy. Let's see if this works for you and your listeners.
We love analogies here.
Do you? Oh, all right. We're going to get amongst it. Okay. So I'm going to take you on a little like 3-minute journey. So just buckle up, buttercup. Here we go. Okay. So let's pretend, like, as audiologists, we look for evidence. We look for evidence of problems, and we can find evidence of problems in a person's test results and in their symptoms, right? Let's pretend that one piece of evidence is a jelly bean. Okay, that seems weird, right? People are like, hey, what? All right. So a person can have a lot of evidence. They can have, let's pretend a person is a jar. They can have a lot of jelly beans in their jar, or they can have very little jelly beans in their jar. Now, when they look at their jelly beans with all of the different colors of jelly beans together, it might feel confusing and overwhelming, right? Like, okay, there's a lot in there. When they come to an audiologist, they need the audiologist to take the jelly beans and separate each color into a different container. Right? So blue jelly beans, they're here. And these blue jelly beans, they're evidence of all of the same problem. We can find evidence in a person's symptoms and in their test results. So it can confirm what we're seeing there. But test result jelly beans are just as important as symptom result jelly beans or symptom jelly beans. So if a person is telling me, I can't hear in background noise. And if you do a test and you don't see that problem, you're using the wrong test. Right? We need to find things. If a person has a symptom, we need to find a test that shows that symptom. And you know what? It's funny that with an audiogram, we'll be like, okay, so let's say that a person has like a normal audiogram, right? But we might think, but maybe before what happened recently, they were at like negative 10, right? So what, when they're at zeros across the board on their audiogram, when they can hear everything super quiet, maybe beforehand, they could hear even better than that. But for some reason with auditory processing, we're like, nope, it's normal, totally normal. it's always been normal. I'm sure it's been normal. You know, like, it is funny because I think audiology has this disconnect that if their tests that they're using aren't showing the problem, then the person doesn't have a problem. But what I think our job is as audiologists is not to test a person to tell them if they have a problem or not. It's to help listen to what their problems are, measure what their problems are, and solve their problems. Get rid of their freaking jelly beans. So my husband was like, okay, if I brought my car in because I had a problem with my tires and you checked my windshield, you played around with my steering wheel, and then you, like, I don't know, touch the back seat. You can tell I'm not a mechanic. And you told me I don't have a problem, I would be very irritated, right? So, yeah, what do you think of that?
You know, it makes me think of patients that we've tested, certainly I've had, that have been in tears at the results. I almost don't want to tell them that it's normal. I don't want to tell them that their hearing is normal. And if they didn't come in for the purposes of auditory processing, certainly I've had patients come in at 5 o'clock in the afternoon for a hearing test, and I have to tell them that their hearing is normal. And I can't do an auditory processing evaluation at 5 o'clock. Just, it's too taxing for the end of the day for them. Then they're so sad. But then I bring up the idea of APD, and then they brighten up. Whoa, there might be an alternative diagnosis.
Right, exactly. And it makes them feel heard and understood, right?
We talk
to our... And how would we want to feel in that same situation?
Absolutely. And we talk to our students about dig deeper. So you did an audiogram. Well, you did a 6-frequency audiogram. How are you telling your patient they have normal hearing? Okay, now you did a 10-frequency audiogram. You have more data points. Did you do OAEs? Do you know if there's anything wrong with the outer hair cells that's not showing up in the audiogram? Well, if that's all normal, have you talked about temporal processing changes? Have you talked about shifts within the normal range? So there are so many things to help answer the patient's question, what brought them in your door, even if you don't get the... introduce the idea, hey, we want to do an APD eval because that's the next step. We took the first step today. The first step didn't entirely answer our question, but it ruled some things out. Let's take the next step and see where that leads us. And you have to know that this tool is in your belt to potentially address your patient's concern.
Yeah, completely. You are hitting the nail on the head. Both of you get this. This is awesome.
Now, with the Buffalo model, it's so language heavy. How do you go about assessing somebody when they come in with sort of language related issues, whether English is not their first language or they have an actual diagnosed language disability?
Well, I don't know about you guys, but most of my day, I'm using language.
You're just kidding.
Okay. All right. So no, I think I understand what you're saying. And there's this feeling in audiology that SLPs do this and audiologists do that. And I think that speech sounds, phonemes, are well within our scope of practice as audiologists. We need to be able to identify, can a person recognize speech sounds, right? So the most important thing is to find out from the client, what language do they want to communicate in? All right. If their problem is communicating in English, is there anything I can see from an auditory perspective that could use some remediation and help them and improve their lives? So we are becoming problem solvers, right? So there is a test. Do you have the CD with the central test battery on it with the SSW? I think most people have one sitting around somewhere.
I don't think in this office because we have it all loaded on computers.
Okay, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you have your Buffalo model central test battery on your computer, there's a test called the phoneme recognition test where it's literally just saying a sound and the client says it back. And so that doesn't have to be language dependent. Mm-hmm. It's speech sound dependent, but not necessarily language dependent. There are other tests. Batteries that I, or tests that I have brought into my work because it adds richness to my understanding of the client. I have worked with some children who have selective mutism, and when they come into the office, they are not ready to talk to me. And so being able to have some tests that don't require a verbal response are really important and very helpful to have. Something like Acoustic Pioneer's Feather Squadron. So this is an app-based auditory processing evaluation created by Matt Barker. It's bright and fun, like Angry Birds. I do this test as a complement to what I do in person with the client, but I often will do a case history with someone. Then we'll sit down and I'll plug a splitter into an iPad. You have to turn the volume up one notch if you're using a splitter. And I will watch as the child or the adult is doing that Acoustic Pioneer Feather Squadron. Have you guys seen that test?
I have not.
It is amazing. Like, it literally looks like Angry Birds. And so it takes them through 8 different skills, and it just helps you gather a bit of data. And it also allows me to observe that child. What does that child do when they're frustrated? Like, what do they do when they're being challenged? And so that test is really cool. And then it has this printout that comes up as soon as you're done with the test. So that's really neat. And then I'll have them take a break, come back, and then I'll finish the rest of the testing. But what I think is really, so that's nice because it doesn't require a verbal response at all. Mm-hmm. There's also a test called the Auditory Skills Assessment, which is created by somebody up in your area, Donna Geffner and Ronald Goldman. And Donna created this test, and it has normative data for children down to 3.5 years of age. Mm. So we have auditory processing tests with normative data down to 3.5 or 4 years of age. I think a lot of people think you can only test at 7, mm-hmm. which is a problem, because if we know that, you know, that auditory skills underpin early literacy, we need to be able to test as early as possible to pick up on those issues before a child starts noticing it and feeling self-conscious. So there's that test. And then there's also the phonemic synthesis picture test. I have modernized that with a couple colleagues, Claire La Riviere from Perth, where we've updated what the pictures look like for that test. So there's a lot of things we can do that take away a verbal response. But I think actually staying with things that are language-based is quite relevant, right? That helps add the richness.
For many or most, if not all, facilities by us, that cutoff is 7 years old. That was actually the origination of my question regarding treating symptoms, that if facilities are not doing testing at that stage, would you advise parents to seek out having their symptoms treated and see if there's improvement versus the waiting?
So I do like to get as many test result jelly beans as I can. Mm-hmm. So I want to see how much evidence of auditory processing there is. And using those tests I just talked about, Feather Squadron, Acoustic Pioneer's Feather Squadron, the ASA, the phonemic synthesis picture test, you can get data on children as young as 3.5. For children who are younger than that, you can do observations and note all of the speech sounds that they're saying, all of the words that they're saying, gathering that data, using validated questionnaires. So yes, I think that let me back up just a little bit. Yeah. I am so sorry. I'm kind of all over the place. We have seen a doubling of the number of clinicians doing auditory processing, testing, and treatment since the beginning of the pandemic. I don't know if you realize that it has grown that fast. Mm-hmm. So we were at 250 in 2020. We are now at 532 mm-hmm. clinicians worldwide doing this work. Still doesn't quite touch the 300 million people who have these problems, but you know what? Baby steps, my friends. Nice. Rome was not built in a day. But the average clinician who is joining and doing this work are testing children five and older on average. They are able to do this work over Zoom, both testing and treatment. Of course, on the really littlies, you want to be in person, we'll be honest. And a majority of these people are working both doing testing and treatment, and they're working with people who have hearing loss, autism, and other types of neurodiversity like ADHD. So the new audiologist who's coming on to do this work is working with a much larger, wider population than those of the past.
Now, by us, there are certain insurance companies that do not cover auditory processing related services because they view it as experimental. And it winds up being then for those families, those parents, they need to pay out of pocket for those services to be able to access them. On the advocacy end, when it comes to legislation or working with insurance companies to get things changed, is there any advice, any direction you would give on that front to try and make changes to have this testing be more universally accepted?
Number one, I'm putting Aetna on blast. Aetna, are you listening to this podcast? Because you are the problem.
Glad you name dropped it.
They can't hurt me. I'm in Australia. Try to find me. All right. Anyway, Aetna has been sending the same letter for about 20 years. And luckily, there have been some people who have gotten it overturned. Because that same letter has been sent out so many times. We think that auditory processing is experimental. Yeah, screw you, Aetna. I've said it. I'll say it again. But number one, if you do not have clinicians doing the work, it doesn't make sense to do any advocacy because there's nobody doing anything, right? But we have hit a critical point. We are hitting this point where there are enough clinicians doing this work that we can start doing that kind of advocacy. But let's be honest, what service is properly paid for by insurance as far as audiology is concerned?
None.
We all want it to be because our patients are like, oh, is this covered by my insurance? Because if you are a non-audiologist listening to Hear Us Out right now, I need to tell you that the whole thing is a scam, right? In the US, audiology services are not valued by 100%. Insurance company. So like, it's really funny that a lot of audiologists come to me and they're like, how can we increase reimbursement? I'm like, how can we increase reimbursement for anything, right? I will say that there are some unicorns like Rich Hogan, who is in Ear Care of St. Louis. He was on the ASHA board for insurance a long time ago. He's doing a majority of his clinical work is doing auditory processing work that is covered by insurance. So there are people who have figured out how to do this. However, I would say in general, this is a more sustainable practice for audiologists to be private pay. But luckily, when you are doing something valuable, it can be valued. And I would say that this is probably one of the highest value services we can do over Zoom, right? Completely over Zoom.
What are you doing over Zoom more specifically?
So at the current moment, I am working with clients who have auditory brainstem implants.
Okay.
So I am also, Eric, working with people who have 0% word recognition. And if you take a person from 0% word recognition to 8% open set word recognition, that is actually a huge change in their lives.
Sure.
Right? And we have to capture that data, which is really good.
We want our cochlear implant patients to recognize that also.
Right? Exactly. And I think when I was in my cochlear implant class at the University of Kansas, and I said, should we assess the auditory processing in people with auditory or with who are about to get CIs? Like, they looked at me like I was a crazy person, and now I'm doing it, which is so exciting. So honestly, I think that, like, first of all, you asked, what do I do over Zoom? I can assess and treat auditory processing disorder through Zoom.
How does that work in terms of, like, administering some of these tests over Zoom. Right?
Okay. So
sorry to interrupt the answer.
No, it's quite all right. It's quite all right. So Doug Beck has the article on the 2-minute speech and noise test. If you put it all together, it's the speech and noise test. That's what I tried to say at first. But he has the 2-minute speech and noise test. And he says that when you're doing supra threshold testing, we are not trying to find someone's hearing thresholds. It requires slightly less precision. Okay. We don't need the noise floor to be as low. And we are checking to see how somebody's understanding something at a comfortable level. Now, before I do any of this testing online, I have a current audiogram from someone who lives near them where they have looked in their ear canals, they have done tympanometry, they have done an audiogram because we need to see what that person's hearing sensitivity is. Now, a lot of people would reject those who have any kind of hearing loss, which I'm like, you're missing out on all the fun because that is a really amazing spot to be in. So anyway, so I have a hearing test result. Then what I do is I open up a portal on the client's side of the computer. So we log in on their side because we need to make sure that me sending the sound to them isn't creating a longer latency. We need the timing to be correct from their end. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so we can test speech and quiet quite easily. We can test speech and noise because the signal to noise ratio is maintained no matter what the volume is. So the client puts the volume where they're comfortable, and then we can make a note of what computer they're using, what headphones they're using, and what the volume is on their side. And that can tell us, all right, this is where it is at now. It allows us to take that pretest data. And then after therapy, we can retest with those same factors and compare apples to apples.
So you're controlling the input variables to see what the therapy has done then on the back end.
Disco baby cakes.
And you can do a dichotic test, no problem, as long as they have headphones.
Yes, queen.
Wow.
So
yeah. So I have a like a little video where I like check to make sure that it is separating because there will be people where they have headphones on and they'll start doing this. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is not splitting. Yeah. And it took me a long time to troubleshoot how I would check that. But now I've got a process. Yes.
So how are you assessing people who have sensory neural hearing loss?
Carefully. Just kidding. Okay, so first of all, what's most important to me is how is that person doing in their day-to-day lives? So first I'm checking their symptom result, Jelly Bean. So I'm doing an HHIA. I want to see, are they noticing impacts, the psychosocial impacts of hearing loss for themselves? I want to see how they do with the hearing aids on and how they do without them. So I want questionnaires that are telling me how much does just the hearing aid help? Mm-hmm. And then do they need further help even if they're wearing the hearing aids? So that's step number one. One of the things that I have learned in my more recent journey of testing the auditory processing in people with hearing loss is find out if they feel like they actually have a problem. Because if they don't actually have a problem, first of all, people with auditory processing will tell you that they have a problem. There is no denial there. But people who are doing quite well, who actually have great auditory processing in addition to having hearing loss, will tell you they don't have any problems and you can believe them and just kind of move on. There was one woman where her HHIA score, it goes from 0 to 100 and 0 is awesome and 100 is awful. And she was at 12, right? And she had bilateral cochlear implants. And we did 12 weeks of auditory training. At retest, her HHIA had dropped to 8. So it had dropped 4 points. It felt like the biggest waste of my time. She was like, no, it was really great. It was really helpful. I'm like, no, that just was not satisfying enough.
But if so you were if selling something, it'd be 50% improvement.
Right. I mean, you are winning, my friend. I love that, especially because I'm being hypocritical with my 0 to 8% thing I said earlier. But anyway, it if a person tells you I'm doing well, because I don't think that all clients with hearing loss need auditory processing help. There are people who remarkably have great auditory processing despite having hearing loss. How does that work? I have no freaking clue. I think they must be just cognitively able to compensate so well, and they're able to handle this distorted signal so well. But yeah, my goal is to take those who don't have great processing in addition to hearing loss, improve the processing, and see what the outcomes of that can be.
See, I would think those are the patients that we are shuffling toward oral rehab programs, which I would see auditory training is falling underneath that, that we all have our patients who it's like, wait a second, you're aided, you're properly aided, your hearing aids are properly fit. Why are you doing so poorly? Hey, let's get you into an AR program where we can hopefully get you some improvement, maybe work with accessories or whatever. It sounds like maybe those patients have underlying auditory processing disorders that have either never been identified because it's masked by hearing loss or whatever the reason, that maybe if we looked at those patients as though they were an auditory processing patient, that maybe we could better service them.
Yes, queen. 100%.